They wrote in the old days that it is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. But in modern war, there is nothing sweet nor fitting in your dying. You will die like a dog, for no good reason. Ernest Hemingway.
This is how liberty dies.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host, Scott, and as always, I'm lucky to be joined by Uncle Ian. This week, we're in Spain for the battle between the king and the general. Catholic fanatic and king of half the planet, Philip II, is up against Catholic fanatic and friend of fascists, General Franco.
Liberty Dies is a history podcast obsessed with history's biggest dictators. We have created a knockout competition to determine the single biggest dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup of two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Up first, King Philip II. Uncle Ian, please kick us off.
Thanks, Scott. Philip II of Spain, also known as Felipe el Prudente, his father named him as a prudent individual. Born 21st of May 1527 at Valladolid in Castile. We have a description from Fagolo, who was the Venetian ambassador. He said that Philip was slight of stature, round-faced, pale, blue eyes, dresses very tastefully, courteous and gracious. Now, even if that lost a little bit in the translation, I don't think that's going to help Philip when we do Dictator Bingo.
No, not at all. I think what may help him with Dictator Bingo is another quote that one of his ministers said, which was that he had a smile cut from a sword.
So Spain at the beginning of the 16th century was undergoing rapid transformation. The population of 7 million had watched Ferdinand and Isabella bring together the ancient kingdoms of Aragon and Castile. They'd seen the Moors, an Islamic presence in Spain since the 8th century, driven back across the Strait of Gibraltar. The Pope labelled Ferdinand and Isabella as the Catholic monarchs, a name they bore with pride. They'd launched the Inquisition, expelled the Jews, commissioned Columbus, and started the colonisation and the exploitation of the New World. Philip was their great-grandson. He was a Habsburg monarch. His father, Charles V, was a successor to Charlemagne as Holy Roman Emperor. His mother, another Isabella, was Princess of Portugal. His parents, Scott, were cousins. That theme's going to continue. During the 16th century, the Habsburgs also ruled the Holy Roman Empire in Central Europe, the Low Countries, which we now know as Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, and large parts of Italy. Philip's titles would include, deep breath, King of Naples, King of Sicily, Duke of Milan, Philip I of Portugal, Archduke of Austria, Duke of Burgundy, Count of Artois, and Count of Zeeland, among countless others.
Zeeland's in the Netherlands?
Zeeland's in the Netherlands.
Hence New Zealand?
That's correct, because remember that the first European to discover New Zealand was Tasman, a Dutchman. Hence the name New Zealand. As a youth, Philip was studious, softly spoken, and cautious. His father trusted him from the age of 16 to serve as regent of Spain, while Charles was off elsewhere in his dominions. Philip married four times and outlived all his wives. This list gives an insight into dynastic politics and the intermarriage typical of the Habsburgs. At the age of 16, he married Maria Manuela, who was Princess of Portugal. He'd already met Maria because she was his double first cousin.
What do you mean by double first cousin?
First cousin on both his father's side and his mother's side. At the age of 27, he married his father's cousin. Her name was Mary, daughter of Henry VIII of England.
This is Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary. Mary's mother was Catherine of Aragon, who had raised her in the Catholic faith. Philip was styled as King of England and Ireland, including on the coinage, and had the entitlement to sign royal warrants. During the marriage, and this is somewhat ironic, Philip II helped upgrade and modernise the English navy. Mary died childless in 1558. Had there been any children from the marriage, history, I think, would have been rather different.
Well, could you imagine, Uncle Ian, if England remained Catholic, rather than Mary dying, it passes to Elizabeth, the Protestant, and then all of England becomes, all of Britain becomes Protestant very quickly.
Well, I mean, we're going to hear about some wars that split on Catholic lines just during Philip's lifetime, but years and centuries of conflict with France would have turned out rather differently. Would Ireland still be part of England? Predominantly Catholic Ireland, would that still be part of England today?
And North America being Catholic would be very strange.
Well, the Quebec people might have a view on that, but the rest of North America, yeah, it may be that Catholicism would have been much more widespread. And conversely, the Protestant Reformation may have, certainly in what became the British Empire, may have taken rather a different turn. But the thought that Queen Elizabeth may not have been Elizabeth I at all is quite a dramatic concept. Philip subsequently sent a note of proposal to Elizabeth. That was unsuccessful. As we know, Elizabeth never married.
Didn't like the ring? What was it?
I don't know that it came with a ring. I think it was more what in the office we call an expression of interest.
Right.
That perhaps was a bit shy on commitment. But of course, at that stage, Elizabeth in her early 30s was still playing the field because she wanted to maximise the political advantage of still being unmarried. So she saw her being single as an advantage.
She kept that up for quite some time.
Yes, by the time she was well into her 60s, perhaps that advantage was no longer quite what it had originally been. At the age of 32, Philip married Elizabeth of Valois, daughter of Henry II of France. And at the age of 43, he married his niece Anna of Austria. So all four wives predeceased him. Sadly, very few of the children of those marriages survived. And when you look at the family relationships, perhaps that gives you a clue. Having become King of Spain in 1556, Philip established himself in Madrid, which was the new capital of Spain. Philip saw himself as having been born to defend the Catholic faith, pretty much against anyone who wasn't Catholic. That included the Huguenots in France.
They're the Protestant group in France.
The Ottomans, the Netherlands, where there was a very brutal Habsburg occupation, and also the widespread Protestant Reformation throughout Europe, especially throughout the German states. In 1571, we saw the defeat of the Ottomans at the Battle of Lepanto. Eventually, Philip signed a treaty in 1585.
That was kicked off by the Ottoman raids in the Balearic Islands. And that's, for those not paying attention, is Ibiza, Majorca, and etc. I imagine Ibiza would be very different today had the Ottomans been allowed to remain there.
Yeah, I haven't been there, but I suspect you're right. I don't think it would quite have resort status.
No, I think there'd be much less cocaine as well.
In 1580, there was a dynastic crisis in neighbouring Portugal. As we've heard, his mother was a princess of Portugal, and his uncle had been king of Portugal. However, all the cousins squabbled over the throne, and in 1580, Philip ended up being successful, partially because he had the Spanish army on his side. So Portugal and Spain weren't united as countries, but the two crowns were united.
Much like Scotland and England.
Much like Scotland and England under the rule of James I. Two were separate countries, separate kingdoms, but the two crowns just happened to be on the one head.
And they called him James I and James VI?
That's correct.
So I think in Portugal, Philip's called Philip I.
That's right. During the 1580s, we saw, well, perhaps not so much you or me, Scott, but certainly the Spaniards saw, diminishing relations with England, especially over support for the Protestant uprising in the Netherlands. There was also a lot of conflict in the Americas. One Francis Drake was making a nuisance of himself, as well as a lot of the other state-sanctioned privateers.
And they're robbing the Spanish galleons.
Yes, exactly right. And if you want to know the difference between a privateer and a pirate, I think it really depends on the extent to which the monarchy is happy for you to go off and rob other countries. The national flag that you were fighting against probably determined whether you were a privateer or a pirate, even though the methods were very similar.
Yeah.
And the outcomes were very similar. In 1587, England executed Mary, Queen of Scots. We'll give you an insight into how all these families are related. Both Mary and Philip had married into the French royal family. So they were married to siblings at one stage. So Mary, Queen of Scots, had been his sister-in-law.
Makes it very awkward at Christmas, doesn't it?
It's extremely awkward at Christmas time when you've got all these Isabellas and Marys and two Elizabeths in this story as well. So it's all very confusing. That was pretty much the last straw for Philip. He realised that England was irretrievably anti-Catholic. So the note of proposal after the death of Bloody Mary was long forgotten. In 1588, the Spanish Armada set sail. The aim was to link up with the Spanish armies in the Netherlands, transport them across to England. So having been married to one daughter of Henry VIII, he subsequently sent 55,000 men and 137 ships against the other daughter, the one to whom he'd once sent a note of proposal. Very ambitious plan, and the weather wasn't on their side.
Well, it is England.
Yes, that's exactly right. We hear a lot from the English about Drake and Hawkins fighting the Spanish, but the weather did a lot of that work for them. Amazingly, a few years later, they tried again. So both in 1596 and 1597, two more unsuccessful armadas. And the Anglo-Spanish War, in fact, continued after Philip's death, right through until 1604, by which time James VI and I was on the throne. I mentioned the Spanish Inquisition, set up by his great-grandparents with the blessing of the Pope. The Spanish Inquisition was meant to be about anti-heresy. But heresy came to mean whatever the Catholic Church in Spain wanted it to mean. Trying to get rid of as many Muslims, Jews, and Protestants as possible. If they wouldn't convert, often at the end of a weapon, if they wouldn't convert and they wouldn't go into exile, then they were imprisoned and tortured and often executed. It's impossible to know the death toll from the Spanish Inquisition because it did run from the 1470s right up until the 18th century. But in the 16th century, the estimate is around the 30,000 mark of executions. That's not counting people who were expelled or people who were imprisoned and tortured just for their faith. Even people who converted were not above suspicion because they weren't convinced that a lot of the conversions were genuine.
Well, that's what happens when you force people to convert.
Precisely. So perhaps not the methods, but certainly the concept fitted in very strongly with him believing he was defender of the faith.
Oh, very much so. And that, not just the Inquisition, but the conquest of the Dutch Republic and the failed invasion of England all ties into him purely just wanting to spread Catholicism as far as he could. He took this very seriously, once saying, "Before suffering the slightest damage to religion in the service of God, I would lose all of my estates and 100 lives if I had them, because I do not wish, nor do I desire, to be the ruler of heretics."
It's a bit of a scorched earth policy, but it gives you an idea how strongly he believed. Can I use the word fanatical, Scott?
You can.
Yeah.
The only people who were spared from this were the Native Americans. They weren't his people to judge or to rule.
Yeah. I think that was also an assessment of Native American culture as well, whether they were worthy of worshipping a Catholic God. What we do remember about the native population of the Americas is the excesses against the Incas, against the Aztecs. Spain came very strongly to rely upon gold and silver from the Americas in order to finance things like the war in the Netherlands, the wars against the Ottomans, keeping the Moors out of southern Spain, financing the Armada, a lot of that.
The treatment of the Native Americans by the Spanish was a point of great contention not just now, but even at the time, when Columbus kept sending Native American slaves back to Isabella. Isabella kept saying, stop sending me slaves. I don't want them. This is abhorrent. This is awful. So her very Catholic mindset was very judgmental of Columbus, despite the fact that she had commissioned him initially.
So during the 1590s, as Philip was coming towards the end of his life, Spanish and Portuguese territories included southern Africa, India, Southeast Asia, such as the Philippines and East Timor, in addition to all the colonies in the Americas. And the fact that Portugal had colonized East Timor was one of the reasons why it was never part of the Dutch East Indies.
And so therefore never became part of Indonesia.
That's right. How did the Philippines get their name, Scott?
I'm going to assume it has something to do with Philip II.
I think that's a very safe assumption. They were quite directly named after Philip II. And the Philippines remained in Spanish control for several centuries after the death of Philip II. He was succeeded by his 20-year-old son, Philip III, who ruled Spain and Portugal until 1621.
Now, Uncle Ian, you also mentioned how he became the ruler of Portugal, which fits into an interesting question, because the reason why Portugal never joined in with Spain in the way that the other corners of Spain did, like Catalonia, for example, which has a very strong national identity, Portugal never joined up with Spain because they were upset at the way that the Spanish and the way that Philip handled their colonies. They didn't look after them well enough, they thought, because they were too busy invading England. And so as a result, the Portuguese said, okay, thank you for being king for a little bit. We're going to go our own separate ways. But could you imagine the power of a combined Spain and Portugal with Brazil, the Philippines, Cuba?
Parts of India, the foothold in the Dutch East Indies that we spoke about, parts of southern Africa. And in addition to that, the extra coverage of the Atlantic coast as well. And Lisbon had such a strong seafaring tradition. So one united Iberian kingdom would have been even more of a powerhouse than Spain was at the time.
You have to always look after your friends and your friends' colonies.
Yeah, well,
so, you know, someone gives you a colony, you got to look after it.
Yeah, I'll try and remember that. Next time I inherit a colony on the other side of the world, Scott, I'll make sure that's on my list of things to do.
That covers Philip II. We're going to have a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about General Franco, the right-wing 20th century strongman and sole reason Spain has the second highest number of mass graves in the world. So, Uncle Ian, Spain has the second highest number of mass graves in the world. Who do you think's number one?
Is it Cambodia?
Well played. You can't get anything past him. Very good. So Francisco Franco was born on December 4th, 1892.
So that's exactly 400 years after Columbus set out from Spain.
Well, give or take a month.
He was born into a naval family in a naval town on the northwest coast of Spain. But little Francisco did not join the navy. Uncle Ian, why do you think that was?
Because at that time, the Spanish Empire that we've just heard so much about was on the way out. The Spanish-American War was the final nail in the coffin of the Spanish Empire. They'd lost the Philippines, they'd lost Cuba, they'd lost various other territories in the Caribbean, and the final wash-up was that Spain didn't have a need for a large navy anymore. It couldn't justify having a large navy anymore. So that meant that Franco wasn't able to follow in the family tradition.
So instead he joined the army, where he was relentlessly bullied for his diminutive size. His comrades even cut off a length of his rifle to force him to carry around a child-size rifle. Stop bullying people, you're creating dictators.
Independent observations of Franco's appearance. I'm going to quote from a journalist who met him and said, "His hand is like a woman's and always damp with perspiration. Excessively shy, his voice is shrill and pitched on a high note, which is slightly disconcerting since he speaks very softly, almost in a whisper. Although effusively flattering, he gave me no frank answer to any question I put to him. I could see that he perfectly understood the implications of even the most subtle query. A less straightforward man I never met.
Franco was an ambitious metal hunter, so he signs up for the colonial army in the Spanish colony of North Africa. It's a dangerous posting, but gives him a high chance of promotion. He conducts himself heroically and sucks up to the right people and is rapidly promoted. He's shot through the stomach and miraculously survives. His injury bolsters his reputation, and his relentless self-promotion also helps. He really is tireless. He's constantly writing to the King of Spain, asking for more medals and promotions. He's then chosen to help lead the Spanish Foreign Legion, which he runs with his trademark ruthlessness towards the enemy and his own men. He kills one of his own soldiers for refusing to eat his dinner. Should I try that at home, Uncle Ian? What do you think?
I think in these days the number of witnesses matters. Perhaps back then it was less of a concern.
Well, he paraded the men past the corpse of the man he had killed to make his point. Franco's colonial army crushes the North African Berbers, fostering a reputation for cruelty and rape and terror inflicted on the locals. His success in North Africa makes him a national hero, and he is promoted to the rank of general. He is the youngest in the history of Spain. So that's our budding dictator, Francisco Franco. Meanwhile, the politics of 1930s Spain is an absolute mess. Outside of Spain, it's often reduced to left against right, but I think that misses out all the fun. There's anarchists, Stalinists, Republicans, Trotskyists, socialists, liberals, conservatives, monarchists, fascists, and Catholics. Plus, there's regional independence movements in Catalonia and Basque regions. Uncle Ian, should we mention the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea?
Bearing in mind, it was 4.5 centuries since Spain had united, so there were long memories of when Aragon and Castile and Catalonia were all different kingdoms. So those independence dreams never died out.
The soft dictatorship of Primo de Rivera ends in 1930. In 1931, the provisional government proclaims a republic and the king flees the country. The left-wing parties win the general election and push through radical changes. The liberal Enlightenment types wanted to remove the influence of the Catholic Church from Spanish life, so they initiated the separation of church and state, allowed freedom of worship, which was somewhat popular. Then, they dissolved the Jesuit order, they banned church schools, despite the fact that the church ran most of the schools in Spain, they confiscated church property, they banned the ringing of church bells in case the bells offend the ears of non-believers. It's very typical culture war stuff that irritates people and produces a predictable backlash. Apart from annoying Catholics, the government also wanted to redistribute land from the landowners to the peasantry. They also sought to reduce the power and influence of the military. So they've angered the church, the wealthy landowners, and the military. What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly.
So in 1932, the army attempted a coup, which failed. But as a consequence of antagonizing the Catholics, the left-wing government lose the 1933 parliamentary elections to a right-wing coalition. However, the president, who was appointed by the previous parliament, refuses to allow the victorious right-wing party to form government. Instead, he makes the leader of the left-wing Republican Party the Prime Minister of Spain. This was considered quite undemocratic, so after a year of pestering, the president allowed some of the right-wingers into cabinet. But having right-wingers in government upset the Marxists, so the Spanish Socialist Workers' Party began a revolt to overthrow the government. This revolt was suppressed by the government with the help of our friend, General Franco, who uses ruthless violence he learned in North Africa to crush the revolt and imprison and execute its leaders. 2,000 people are killed in this failed rebellion. Nevertheless, the country quickly moved on, and in February of 1936, a left-wing coalition of Republicans, Liberals, Socialists, Anarchists, and Communists was democratically elected. But the country is still bitterly divided. Over the next few months, minor political figures from both the left and right are assassinated. The assassinations escalate and culminate in the leader of the opposition party being killed in July of 1936 by the bodyguard of a socialist cabinet minister. So now Spain has a left-wing government and the opposition was dead. So the army decided it was time to stage another coup. Now the government had seen a military coup coming, so they sent our friend General Franco on an important mission to the Canary Islands. But the important mission was being far away from Spain. So Franco hitches a ride to North Africa to reunite with his colonial army, still Spain's most effective and brutal army. And being the head of this army made him the de facto leader of the coup. However, the officers in the Spanish Navy turned on their leaders and sided with the government. They blockaded the Strait of Gibraltar, the narrow body of water between North Africa and Spain, and this prevented Franco and his army from crossing into Spain. Which should be the end of the story. But it's the 1930s and now the fascists get involved. Fascist Italy and Nazi Germany airlift Franco's colonial army from North Africa into Spain. The failed coup now becomes a protracted and bloody civil war. The side of the elected left-wing government and their allies are known to history as the Republicans, which is confusing if you're American, but just remember, Republicans left-wing. And on the other side was the right-wing rebellion, consisting of Franco, his army, and their Catholic, conservative, monarchists, and fascist allies. They are known to history as the Nationalists. Although Uncle Ian, they called themselves Los Nacionales, which I looked up, and it means the Nationals. And this was because they were presenting themselves as the locals, protecting Spain from foreign powers, i.e. the Soviet Union.
Exactly. When you say Republican, that's code for what Franco used throughout his entire dictatorship, promoting himself as being anti-communist. And that started very early in the Spanish Civil War.
The Spanish Civil War lives on in the collective imagination because it's the one country where the great combustible movements of communism and fascism exploded into an open civil war. And the consequences are astonishingly brutal, with city bombings, mob violence, and civilian executions are all commonplace. In 1936, Franco's nationalists controlled southern Spain and the northwest of Spain, including his hometown. But the majority of the country, including Madrid and Barcelona, were under left-wing Republican control. But looking back, the result of the war was never in doubt, because the world signed up to a non-intervention pact, preventing the selling of weapons to either side. But Italy and Germany signed up to the pact but didn't really follow the pact at all and provide weapons and horrific and effective aerial bombings. For these fascist powers, it was just a training run for the war to come. Winston Churchill, who was not yet Prime Minister of Britain, criticised the British non-intervention, stating that a Franco victory would strengthen the position of Nazi Germany. The left-wing Republican forces are further crippled when the alliance between the Liberals, Socialists, Anarchists and Communists proved to be unstable. The Unified Socialist Party declared that their allies, the Workers' Party of Marxist Unification, was a fascist organisation, which, going by the name, seems unlikely. The left-wing infighting culminates in 1937 with the May Day's battle between leftist factions, producing a civil war within the civil war. It was famously described in the book Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell. Just on Orwell, he fought with the communist Trotskyist in Barcelona and was shot in the throat for his trouble. Orwell returned from the hospital to find that the Communist Party he was fighting with had been declared an illegal fascist organization by another Spanish Communist Party and were killing its soldiers. So he decided to sneak across the border into France instead. For more literary greatness, there is also For Whom the Bell Tolls by Ernest Hemingway. These two great writers add to the romance and glamour of the Spanish Civil War, which was heightened by the thousands of volunteers travelling from around the world to take up arms. But the reality of the war is not glamorous, it is vicious. Franco purposely protracts the war, conquering the country slowly. His aim isn't simply to take territory, but to exterminate the Republican population on the ground, targeting civilians with the wrong politics.
We also should remember, Scott, that as well as Franco wanting to drag the Civil War out, the international backers of the two sides had their own reason for wanting the war to drag out as well. Hitler was still rearming and was also starting to ramp up his anti-Semitic program in Germany. And while the Spanish Civil War continued, that distracted attention away from what was happening in domestic Germany. Similarly, the Stalinist purges were at their height in the late 1930s. And again, while the Spanish Civil War continued, that meant there wasn't as much attention on what was happening in Soviet Russia. So ironically, all of the key players in the war were not in a hurry to wrap it up.
Yeah, and the Soviet involvement didn't really help the left-wing side, because the fact that Stalin was involved just produced more infighting, particularly amongst the Stalinists and the Trotskyists.
Yeah, and Trotsky was still alive at this stage. He was alive and living in Mexico. He still had a couple more years to live. The concept of being a Trotskyist was something that communists were very aware of.
Yes, and it basically just meant an anti-Stalinist. Yeah. So we're all Trotskyist here, I think.
So Guernica in northern Spain was the victim of a planned attack by the German Condor Legion. On the 24th of April, 1937, the population of Guernica was swelled to 10,000 because it was market day. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the bombers of the German Condor Legion moved in. Men, women and children were sitting ducks. The death toll, 1,645 in that one afternoon, plus thousands more wounded. The worst thing, Scott, about the bombing of Guernica was that initially Franco denied that it had happened. Then he tried to blame it on his opponents. When evidence through the survivors identified that it was German planes that had committed these atrocities, he then said that they were acting of their own accord, not on his behalf. However, that was the extent of his protests. Surely if he hadn't authorised the attack, he would have broken off relations with the Condor Legion and sent them packing, but he did no such thing. One of the reasons that the name Guernica has become so evocative is because Picasso captured the images in his famous artwork, and that helps us remember that it wasn't only the troops who were the victims of the Civil War, but the civilian population itself was outwardly and deliberately targeted on both sides.
Yes, the Republican side are also busy committing their own atrocities. They infamously murder 7,000 priests, monks, and nuns. They burn down churches and even stage an execution of the statue of Jesus in Madrid by firing squad. This extremism would fuel Franco's propaganda, who declares his war a religious crusade. Franco conquers Barcelona and then enters Madrid and declares victory in April of 1939. In total, 500,000 people die in the Spanish Civil War. 200,000 of these were by systematic targeted killings, and mob violence. Republican women are raped, have their heads shaved, and forced to take laxatives and are paraded through the streets, unable to control their bowels. Franco sent another 500,000 Spaniards to 60 concentration camps around Spain. A further 500,000 fled into France, which in 1939 is not a good time to be in France. France is conquered by the Nazis the following year, who used the Spanish refugees as forced labour or send them to concentration camps. It's 1939, and General Franco is now the ruler of Spain, known as El Caudillo. And Uncle Ian, what does El Caudillo mean?
It depends on which particular dialect, remembering that there's lots of different languages in parts of Spain.
Don't tell Franco that.
No, I won't tell. However, but the translation that he and his cronies wanted to put across was that he was the warrior king.
So you've got the Führer in Germany, Il Duce in Italy, and El Caudillo in Spain. And so the question you all have is Franco a fascist? Okay. So he was certainly called a fascist by his opponents at the time, but his opponents also called each other fascists, so they're not particularly reliable. Franco was an authoritarian conservative, not a fascist. Fascism is a revolutionary movement bent on forging new men for a new society, obsessed with speed, youth, modern machinery, violence, Darwinism, and the rejection of Christian teachings. Whereas Franco's Spain had none of these. He did not want to move Spain into a new future. He attempted to preserve the Spain of the previous century. Church-going, agrarian, and ruled by the army and the landowners. He aligned himself with fascist powers during the Civil War to help him win it, and then after the war, he weakened and disempowered Spain's fascist party. General Franco is actually much more similar to his Portuguese equivalent, the dictator Antonio Salazar, another conservative authoritarian. Salazar famously said, "Fascism is essentially pagan and incompatible with the character of our Christian civilization."
One of the other elements of fascism, it's about the succession. It's about, does the fascist state survive beyond the dictator? By the time of the 1960s, Franco wanted to be seen as someone who was ensuring the continuity of Spain by bringing it back to the monarchy. And during the 1960s, he wanted to portray himself as more grandfatherly and more as a regent, preparing Juan Carlos to return to the throne when Franco was no longer on the scene. That's not consistent with the fascist dictatorships that were hell-bent on ensuring that the party survived above all.
Yes, I can't imagine Hitler handing off power to Wilhelm III.
Exactly.
Of course, just because Franco's not a fascist doesn't mean he's a good time. He continues the White Terror, even once the war is won, to cleanse Spanish society of undesirable elements. Liberals, socialists, homosexuals, Protestants, Freemasons, as well as regional independence advocates. He even bans the Catalan and Basque languages from being spoken in Spain. Tens of thousands of newborn babies are taken away from their mothers at birth and given to couples loyal to the regime. That is horrific. He, of course, implements his conservatism into policy. Women are encouraged to dress conservatively and encouraged not to read magazines or novels, particularly women between the ages of 18 and 35. I suppose old women, he doesn't care about them. They can do what they like. Women cannot even open a bank account without their husband's or father's consent. Franco also restores the primacy of the Catholic Church. Public servants must be Catholic, and certain jobs require a letter of recommendation from a priest. He also places 500,000 undesirable Spaniards in internment camps of forced labour. No records are kept. Victims and perpetrators were silenced. No one knew or wanted to know. The reality of it all is only now being uncovered. The site of one camp in southern Spain is now a tourist amusement park called Aqualand. There is no better metaphor for the peculiar amnesia of Spain's past. Spain is known for pleasant beaches, not for its concentration camps. And so, of course, reconciliation for the war does not occur. The Catholic Church actually attempts it, but Franco suppresses it. Instead, he spends the next 40 years justifying the coup and demonizing, arresting, and murdering dissidents. Tens of thousands are brought to military courts. Now, it seems that Franco wanted to ensure he scored well on dictator bingo. In 1947, he organized a referendum asking the public whether he should become dictator for life. According to Franco, 95.1% said, yes, please do. I'm very skeptical. I cannot express my skepticism at that number. So, Uncle Ian, we should talk about the Second World War. General Franco abandons his fascist allies in the Second World War and keeps Spain neutral. He does make a symbolic gesture and changes Spain's time zone to match Germany's rather than Britain's. So this means the clocks are out of sync with the sun, giving Spain very dark mornings and sunny evenings, contributing to Spain's famously late dinner times. You know, they eat dinner at like 9:30. It's horrific. This is why, and they still have it. It's very strange.
And certainly Hitler was pretty upset. He felt that Franco and Spain owed Nazi Germany for the help that had been provided during the Spanish Civil War. In reality, Franco didn't want to alienate the West more than he had to. Secondly, Spain in 1940 would have only been providing symbolic assistance. The country, as we've heard, had been destroyed during the Civil War.
And given the result of the war, remaining neutral turned out to be a genius move. So instead of being invaded by the Allies, in 1953 he signs the Pact of Madrid with the United States and they become best friends.
Yeah, and the Cold War played into Franco's hands. As we've heard a lot, Scott, with some of the dictators that we've covered, being anti-communist in the 50s and 60s was a good way to become friends with the US. Franco even took up golf so that he could play golf with President Eisenhower.
Yes, Franco is an opportunist. He will ally himself with whoever will help him maintain power. He adopted the style of fascism when fascism was popular, and then he adopts anti-communism to attract US support during the Cold War. Now, Uncle Ian, here's the part of the show where we talk about dictators' propaganda for dictator bingo. Franco has always been a shameless self-promoter, and now he has the apparatus of the state to do so. He preaches the three blessings of the regime: peace, stability, and prosperity. That reminds me of the quote about the Romans. What is it? The Romans would create a desert and call it peace.
Oh, yeah, destroy the town to save it.
Franco claims that the country would fall into another civil war without his strong rule. He even tells the country that his mother was visited by an angel before his birth who told her that he was sent by God to save Spain from poverty and chaos. So he's cast himself as Jesus Christ in this story. Franco actually writes, directs, and produces an autobiographical film about his leadership during the war, which he releases in 1942. In true dictatorial style, he rewrites and edits the movie as the times change and as it suits him. So after the defeat of Hitler and Mussolini, he orders the original copies of the movie to be destroyed and releases a new version without depictions of fascism. And then criticisms of America are edited out when they become his ally. And then during the Cold War, the film is edited to refer to his Civil War enemies as communists rather than Republicans. So any old dictator can doctor photos. Only Franco doctors his own feature films.
The other element of that, based on a true story film, was that depending on his troubled relationship with his father and one of his brothers, kept editing the film to portray the mythical super family in the light of whatever was the family dispute that was going on at the time. We talked today about a living document. That film was very much like that. He wanted it to be as up-to-date as possible, depending on the message he was trying to put across.
His brother was one of the lefties burning down churches. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that was a topic of conversation at Christmas as well.
Indeed.
So the country of Spain is a mixed bag. 13 years of famine, and then he introduced free market capitalists into his cabinet, who opened up Spain for trade, removed regulation and taxes, and banned workers' strikes, which really encourages the investment of foreign corporations. The economic boom that follows is known as the Spanish Miracle and helped Franco justify his dictatorship.
In late 1966, Franco was paving the way for what would happen as he got older, and it went to referendum. You'll be happy to know, Scott, that less than 2% voted no in the referendum.
He's improved because it was 5%.
Precisely. Yeah, so he's learnt about referendum tactics. When campaigning, he said, "I was never motivated by ambition for power. From my youngest days, they placed on my shoulders responsibilities beyond my years and rank. I would have liked to enjoy life like so many ordinary Spaniards, but the service of the patria, the country, monopolised my every hour and took up my life. For 30 years, I have steered the ship of state, safeguarding the nation from the storms of the contemporary world."
That's perfect. I love that. That's so revealing, that last line. The storms of the contemporary world. It really shows the conservative mindset that he has. What he really wants was the Spain he was born into.
And maybe in his mind, it still was.
But there is one thing that can end the rule of a dictator for life, and that is death. And Franco's occurred in 1975, almost 40 years after the beginning of the Civil War. During his rule, Franco has remade Spain into a monarchy without a king and had appointed Prince Juan Carlos as his successor. The now king, Juan Carlos, immediately dismantled Franco's one-party state and announced the first democratic elections since 1936.
And just in relation to Juan Carlos, we talked before about the Habsburg dynasty of Philip II. So Juan Carlos, a direct descendant of Philip II. And again, to help understand how complicated the monarchical family trees of Europe are, Juan Carlos is also a direct descendant of Queen Victoria and of Louis XIV.
Oh, there you go. Can't get more kingly than that. In 1981, the king then helped the government thwart a military coup that attempted to return Spain to Francoist-style dictatorship. Franco himself was buried at the colossal Civil War monument, the Valley of the Fallen. After intense public debate, his body was exhumed in 2019 and buried again at a family crypt. This gives you an idea of the shifting public opinion of Franco's legacy as more mass graves are uncovered. The Spanish were told that he was a saint, that he saved the Republic. And they were taught that in schools, they were taught that in churches, they were taught that through the media. And only now, after a few decades of democracy, are they uncovering the truth.
I actually got the chance to speak to a colleague who was based in Valencia in the 1980s. One of the things that he remembers was the fact that all the statues, all the street names, the mausoleum, there was, even after the coup of 1981 that you mentioned, there was no effort to change any of that during the 1980s.
So, Uncle Ian, I have a question for you. They say that those who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. However, you look at Spain, which is a country that was forced to forget. And you look at Bosnia, Rwanda, and even America, countries that have torn themselves apart over their historical feuds. makes me wonder, is forgetting better?
I don't think forgetting is better, because the thousands and tens of thousands of people who were caught up in it all, whether it's the victims at Guernica or the people that were sent to the internment camps, deserves to be remembered and deserve that their ill treatment be at the very least acknowledged. And in Australia, at the time of recording this podcast, we're going through that debate right now.
They say that the job of the historian is to speak for the dead.
One thing I'd like to share with you, one of the Franco biographies. Quote, "No significant head of state, other than General Pinochet, attended the funeral." End of quote.
That's surprising.
Yeah, as you say, Scott, he was an opportunist, and by the time of the Cold War, he'd learned to speak the language that the West wanted to hear. But as his regime went on and on, some of the truth started to come out about the methods that it employed. I'd be absolutely horrified to think that the only head of state that came to my funeral was Pinochet.
Yes, Uncle Ian is very much looking forward to the president of Rwanda, the president of Afghanistan.
I would think as a minimum, but then we haven't finished all our podcasts yet, Scott.
We've had this discussion before around where would you want to live in the 20th century, under which dictatorship. And I think you said in Yugoslavia under Tito. And Tito, he still holds the record for the world's largest funeral with the most heads of state attending. So perhaps there's a relationship between livability under a dictator and funeral attendance.
It's something we might need to factor into dictator bingo as we go.
Another question I have for you is, what if Franco had lost the war?
I think a communist revolution was possible, perhaps likely. The socialists, the communists, the Stalinists, they weren't messing around. They were there to take over, and they were going to use the popularity of, say, the more moderate liberal cause to get their way in and then take over. Would we have had a Spanish Stalin? A Senor Stalin?
Would Hitler have stood by and let that happen? I have a feeling that if it had looked like going the way of the Republicans, that Hitler would have just kept ramping up.
There are historians that claim that if the British got involved and helped the Republican side defeat Franco, there would have not been a Second World War, because Hitler was a gambler, and every time he gambled and rolled the dice, he was successful. If the British had stood up to him and to Mussolini earlier, back when he was weaker,
And the war would have been more localised.
Maybe it would have been over in 1937 and not spread out through the whole world.
It's fascinating to think of that could have been a minor version of what we now call the Second World War that might not ever have needed to be called that.
So, Uncle Ian, we have to pick a winner between Philip II of Spain and General Franco of Spain. Both are horrific, really, when you think about the Inquisition of Philip, the targeting of the Jews, the targeting of Protestants, the invasion of England and of the Dutch Republic. Really serious about this Catholicism, and yet as well we have Franco. Just as serious about Catholicism, killing 500,000 people, interring another 500,000, forcing another 500,000 to flee, and then ruling for such a long period of time.
I've got to balance this out by reminding us that the portrait of Titian does show Philip II had a moustache. But even so, I can't find anything to like about Franco. I think he's horrid, and I think he's the biggest, baddest, meanest out of this pair.
He is, and he's so much worse than most people know.
Mm.
He's so much more brutal. Completely ruthless. The whole concept of protracting a war is something that we've not seen throughout this entire podcast. He's not interested in victory. He's interested in killing people. And I think that means that he wins today.
I think we agree.
So congratulations to General Franco. You remain in the tournament to be crowned history's biggest dictator. Next week, next episode, what are we doing, Uncle Ian?
I think it's time we went to ancient Greece, Scott.
Very good. And it's also ironic that we're going to Greece because, as many Greeks will tell you, they invented democracy. These characters are not that interested in that. So thank you, Uncle Ed, for another fantastic episode. And I'll see you next time in Greece.